Paul Robinson in response.
Thanks. As Andy mentioned, Professor Kloh and I are both responding. I'm not sure if the intention of the committee was for us to gang up on the presenter or they simply assumed it would take two of us to do the job, but anyway, here we are. The other thing I wanted to mention is, for those of you who don't know, my area is historical theology. Professor Kloh's is New Testament. So we've agreed not to show each other up. So I'm going to do more of the talking to the history paper, and he'll have more to say about the New Testament paper this afternoon. So Professor Maxwell, I think, has greatly enlarged the field of play for this symposium by pointing out that there are multiple narratives in Scripture related to the resurrection of Christ. Multiple narratives mean multiple frameworks of meaning and therefore multiple implications of what happened on the morning of the third day of the week. Thus, the theologian who searches for the single right answer to the question, what does Christ's resurrection mean, will invariably be less than fully correct. Something will be missing from the picture of the resurrection. Each narrative has tendencies that, if it is followed to the exclusion of all others, lead to a narrower vision than that of Scripture, and possibly into heresy as well. If the idea of multiple narratives makes you a bit uneasy, that's all the more reason for us to keep listening and talking here. And I will say more about that at the end of my comments, but first, something about the Middle Ages. In Professor Maxwell's defense, he said he wasn't going to address the Middle Ages, but he managed to pack an awful lot into a single sentence about Anselm. And if you don't happen to remember that sentence, I wrote it down here, and I'll read it to you again. Anselm's innovation is to make claims about the necessities of God's justice and the dynamics of how precisely his offended honor had to be satisfied. 2 points there I think are worthy of some further comment. First, Anselm had an opponent in view when he was writing about the atonement. He was opposing the so-called devil's rights theory. How much of a live option that really was is in debate, but that's at least the opponent he sets up. That explanation has Christ's death on the cross serving as bait for the devil. The devil who exercised his rights over the soul of every human being who died. Because Christ was divine as well as human, the devil was without right when he tried to claim Christ's soul. And as a result of that attempt, the devil's power over humanity was broken. Anselm's problem with that view was that it gave the devil a legitimate rather than a usurped authority and possibly called into question the omnipotence of God. To whom could Christ's sacrifice be owed if not to God? Anselm asked. You see, he didn't construct his explanation in some sort of dogmatic vacuum, but as a counter to a competing view of atonement. My second point about Anselm is that he also constructed his explanation in a specific time and place. The offended honor that Anselm ascribes to God does not perhaps cause us to stop and think as it should. Offended honor is a phrase that would make perfect sense to an 11th century nobleman and bishop like Anselm. He was immersed in a culture of honor. Now, whether that's a truly scriptural idea is another question, and one that raises the issue of communication and context in the history of theology. The larger question Professor Maxwell raised is why Anselm or anyone else, when describing the atonement, would focus almost exclusively on the cross rather than on the open tomb. He mentioned that Luther makes use of different narratives when talking about the resurrection, and yet the popular perception of Luther is this focus on the cross. One has only to think of the altarpiece painting that shows Luther preaching with the congregation on one side and Luther pointing to Christ suspended on the cross between himself and the congregation. You see, it seems to me that something happened in the Middle Ages. It could be that certain views of the atonement and the place of Christ's resurrection in it were simply forgotten, but that's not likely. I think it far more likely that the emphasis on the cross comes in response to a larger shift in thought and culture. Although Luther refocused the meaning of Christ's death on the cross from what it had been in medieval theology, popular devotion to the suffering and dying Christ was a prominent feature of Western religiosity for two centuries before the Reformation. That devotion, it could be argued, was in turn a popular expression of a shift in thinking that had taken place by the time of Anselm. Perhaps it went something like this. When the story of Christ was told in the times of the apostles and church fathers, the resurrection of Christ and the future resurrection of believers required lengthy defense and explanation. People simply did not rise from the dead. By the Middle Ages, resurrection was fully believed. It had become a basic assumption. When the great cathedrals were built, practically every single one had a depiction of the general resurrection and judgment over one of its doors. Resurrection was the clear answer to the problem of death, which may be, I think, what raised the question of Christ's death. Christ rose because he had been dead, but why did he have to die in the first place? That was suddenly the question that puzzled Christians. So perhaps it was not the failure of resurrection proclamation, but its success that led to a greater focus on the cross. The point of all this is to encourage us to continue the work that Professor Maxwell has done so capably by asking why. He gave the example of Pieper's dogmatics, so it's fair to ask, why does Pieper maintain the narrative he does to the exclusion of all others? What was it about his context or his opponents that led to his specific articulation of the resurrection? I suspect the answer probably has something to do with Schleiermacher. But seriously, Pieper maintains a traditional narrative in order to safeguard and highlight a Lutheran understanding of justification. He didn't set out to shortchange the resurrection. If that's the long-term effect of his dogmatic approach, we're in a better position to judge than he himself would have been. Perhaps the time has finally come when categories other than Pieper's, that is, traditional Aristotelian categories, not only may, but must be employed in order to communicate fully and effectively our theology. We have definitively come to the end of that era when resurrection, especially bodily resurrection, has been proclaimed so successfully as to be an assumption. So the question for us is, how effectively do we proclaim Christ's resurrection? Why do we understand the resurrection as we do? And, as Professor Maxwell would suggest, can we, in conversation with the theologians who have gone before us, recover scriptural narratives concerning the resurrection that we have allowed to fall by the wayside? And that, as I promised, brings us back to the issue of multiple narratives. We might wonder how an event so central to our proclamation as the resurrection of Christ could still be under any discussion here almost two millennia later. But we might do better to wonder why we would think that an event of such magnitude, historically and cosmically, would have a single, precise, and easily defined meaning.